Hi, this is Arnie Hackett in Raleigh. Today we have Gus Kasimis and Alfred Christensen of the ComServer Design and Strategy Group who are going to take us through concerns with IPv6 and where IPv6 is.
All right, folks. So I guess a couple of opening comments here, you know, as the charts are starting to show up on people's screens is Alfred Christensen is also on the line. And we also have Roy Brapson from our design groups as well here that jointly here I'll be taking us through most of the materials in this package. But as there are questions, we may have others pipe in as well. Okay, so if we can kick this off and we'll move to the first chart that we'll be looking at is chart 4. I'll try to call out the charts for those that may be following along with the PDF document. Just briefly in terms of the agenda, what we're hoping to accomplish here is really give you a view of why IPv6 is important. Why is it important now, right? So you'll see that, you know, IPv6 is not a new topic. I know several of you have probably seen presentations in the past. What is it that makes it interesting to revisit that topic at this point in time? So hopefully we'll go through some of the changes that are happening in the industry that are driving this. We'll talk a little bit about what IPv6 is. We'll focus on the key points that really matter from a planning perspective versus a deep dive on every IPv6, you know, technology feature. We'll talk a little bit about IPv6 penetration, where we're seeing some of the first deployments. We'll then start talking about the last two stages is really about how do you begin to think about deploying IPv6 within your enterprise, how you interact with IP version 4 applications, networks, and so forth. And then finally, a discussion on, you know, how you begin to plan, right, to get from where you are today to an environment where you can support IPv6 as it makes sense within your environment. Okay, so getting right into it, we'll get into chart 6 here. And chart 6 depicts a survey we had done a while back in 2009. This survey may be somewhat familiar to you because I know we did reach out to several of the customers that are on this call. But the question was, from a user point of view, when do you believe that you will need IPv6, both on ZOS and on other platforms within your enterprise? And what you'll see here is that, you know, it was pretty conclusive here in terms of the survey that on ZOS itself, most folks did not really have a good idea on when, right? So even though we had a timeline going out to 2016, there were a few customers that thought they needed it short term, but the majority, again, was in that category. IPv6 on other platforms, you'll see that, yes, there's a variation in terms of a bump of interest in 2011 and 12 for some, but for most, again, they fed into that last category. The key thing that we'll try to accomplish in this session here is, again, understand some of the major drivers for understanding IPv6 and what it will take to begin deploying IPv6, right? So it's really about preparing. If we can, let's see here, move on to the next chart, chart 7. Chart 7 shows a view of IP version 4, and, you know, when we talk about versions, we'll talk about, you know, the fact that IPv6 is the next generation of the Internet Protocol. The current generation of the protocol is IP version 4, even though we don't really refer to it with a V4 when we talk about IP communications. But this, basically, this chart here tries to map out IPv4 address usage since the early 1900s. And this was a chart we had from the summer of 2010 that has not been updated. But you'll see there that we're reaching, you know, up to 800 million IP addresses. Most folks think that the practical limit is a billion, basically, on how many addresses we could support with the current addressing scheme. Well, you'll see there on the left-hand side is projected dates. These were from the summer of 2010 on when we'll have IANA, that will go into more detail, the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, will run out of IP addresses, and at that time they were estimating in May of 2011. And for regional registries, and we'll discuss that in more detail, right, it was 2012. But in any case, I'm just going to flip to the next chart, and that's a modified version that we just updated, actually just a few days ago, chart 8, to basically show where we are. And really, the key thing that we'll focus on is, on the left-hand side there, is that we can remove projected from one of the key numbers that are being tracked in terms of exhaustion of IPv4 addresses. The Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, IANA, that's basically responsible for allocating IP addresses to various regional registries around the world, has basically run out of IP addresses a few weeks back on February 3rd. So that basically means that a regional, again, Internet registry in the Asian Pacific countries, let's say, was to request more IP addresses, they really can't, right? They basically are left with what they have currently allocated within their regional registries. And we'll dig into a little bit more detail there. So the first one we don't have to track anymore because that's a done deal. That was the date that was depicted as May earlier. The regional registries now have a projected date of August 2011. So you'll see that that got moved in by about 6 months. Now, that varies by geography, right? So that's the earliest projection that one of the key registries will run out. So other things that we'll talk about here are government compliance and other things that are focusing on, you know, IPv6 and some of the key drivers. But the key thing that I think most folks understand by now is that really what's driving IPv6 is the lack of IPv4 addresses that are available for new deployments. So the key thing here is that, as we'll see here, as we transition from this point of view where we were projecting that IP addresses may run out at some point, you know, we're at a point where, in some cases, addresses have run out, right? And this is going to start getting a lot more attention, right, in the press, in the industry, and so forth. So we'll talk a little bit about that in more detail as well. So on chart 9, just moving on to there, as we mentioned, this is a website that you can go out there that used to maintain a counter, right, of IP addresses from an IANA perspective, from the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, and you'll see that they no longer have their widget up because it's a done deal. The focus has now been shifted into the regional registries. When will those begin to run out of IP addresses? The key thing here is that it's no longer a future long-term concern, right, but something that we're going to be facing pretty soon, and in some geographies more than others, as we'll see. All right, on to chart 10. So one of the things I just did a search this past weekend just to see how much attention is this topic getting, right, on Google, and you'll see here that we had about 44,000 matches for IPv4 address exhaustion, and you can see some of the key topics that are just popping up there. These specific, you know, results aren't all that significant. I wasn't trying to point out a specific link that you should go off and read, but just the point that this topic is getting a lot more visibility, right? So as folks within your company start getting awareness of this, right, your CEO could get awareness of this, questions on are we ready for IPv6, I think are going to be start to pop, to, you know, to pop up more frequently. We have already heard from customers that are beginning to test with IPv6, and one of the key motivations, I think, that was driving that is some of them turned around and said, we got asked whether we're ready for IPv6 across the board in the entire enterprise from a networking perspective, server perspective, and folks, you know, it triggered activities for folks to go off there and start looking at the topic. So that was the reason for including that link there. If we go to the next chart, chart 11, just another article that popped out on Network World sometime last year about IPv4 address exhaustion and the fact that if folks have spare IPv4 addresses, those might become very valuable commodities in terms of, you know, reselling potentially IP address spaces and so forth. But, again, another view of how this is getting a lot more visibility out there, right? Okay, moving on to chart 12, just a brief discussion here on how our IPv4 addresses allocated. And this is useful even though we're running out of them, because a similar model will be employed for IPv6 as well. But basically, it's a tree structure where at the very top you have the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, and it basically is, you know, in the beginning of time had all the IP addresses, and it would allocate IP addresses actually directly. So you needed an IPv4 address early on in the Internet days. You went to an IANA and you requested a block, and that's how you got them. As the Internet became more popular, folks decided that we really needed a much more formal structure for how we allocate these, not just in the United States, but around the world. And that's when we came up with regional internet registries that were basically geographically dispersed around the world. And those are listed here. We have a chart later on that talks about who's who. But in any case, the regional registries would then get a slice of the IPv4 allocation from IANA as their needs evolved. And they were responsible for giving them out either to ISPs, to Internet Service Providers, in the various geographies, or even smaller registries that were more localized within the various geographies. But bottom line, from there, they got allocated to consumers, companies, and so forth. Okay. The key thing here, as we mentioned, is that top step now is kind of redundant from an IPv4 perspective. There's really no channel for the regional registries to go up to IANA and ask for more addresses. There are none. Basically, whatever's left in the regional registries is basically what can still be allocated, right, to the various geographies. Okay, so moving on to the next chart. If we look at the IPv4 address space and how it's allocated, on the left-hand side, we're basically showing from the entire set of IPv4 addresses how many were allocated where, right? So that's where you'll see now that all these regional internet registries, you see the acronyms there, that I'm not going to cover all of those, but just to give you an example, the ARIN is the regional registry for the Americas, right? So that's where, if you're in the U.S. and the rest of the Americas, that's the registry that assigns IP addresses for that. What you'll see there is the various geographies, right, and what they have. The one slice that's in there, reserved in red, is basically reserved IP addresses that are reserved based on the protocol. There are a certain set of IP addresses that are reserved for the IP protocol itself and cannot be allocated to anyone. What you see there for various, that slice, is basically allocations that were done prior to the formal regional registries being formed. So one of the key things to note there is you'll see that the registry for the Americas has a pretty big slice, allocation of the pie, right, close to a quarter of the IP addresses. You'll see that the one right next to it, the APNIC one, which basically represents the Asian Pacific type of countries, right, has less than what the Americas have allocated. If you start looking at things like population, right, total population in the various geographies there, you would clearly see that there's a disproportional allocation, across those two regional registries, right? In any case, on the right-hand side, you'll see that from all the IPv4 addresses that are allocated, how are they currently being used? So you can see that the assigned and advertised are IP addresses that are fully in use and advertised in the Internet. There is a set of addresses that have been assigned but are not advertised, right? So those could be addresses that are basically internal to enterprise networks and so forth. And then there is a small slice, right, that light blue, that's basically in the unassigned category for the various regional registries. So you can see that that's a pretty small slice that's quickly becoming smaller. So if we move to page 14, so the next counter, there's various Internet IPv4 address exhaustion counters that are out there. The focus has now been on tools that will track when will we run out of IP addresses in the regional registries. So you'll see here that there's this one counter. You can actually click on that URL and track that from time to time. List of various registries, and the projection there is that on August 9th of this year, one of the registries will run out of addresses. And if we had a less number of people on the line, I would actually entertain guesses on which one that is, but I'll just mention it. It is the one for the Asian Pacific countries, the APNIC one. And if you think about it, right, with the population of that geography and the allocation they have and the growing economies of some of those countries, such as China and India and so forth, right, that's it's no surprise that that's going to be the regional registry that's going to run out first. As we'll see, it's also no surprise that it's one of the geographies that has been one of the quickest to start pushing for IPv6 deployment, because they felt this pain several years back, right, in terms of this basically coming to a head. Okay, so moving on to chart 15. So hopefully I gave you ample background on why you should care. And now we'll shift into what is IPv6 and begin thinking about some of the planning. So the key thing that's driving IPv6 is really the being the answer to the IPv4 address spaces, address space becoming basically exhausted, not having any more IP addresses to hand out to new IP hosts, right? There are a lot of other interesting IPv6 features, and some of them are really unique. What we'll find out that some of them have actually been retrofitted even into the IPv4 protocols over time. But there are still some unique, you know, valuable features. But the key thing to note here is it's the IPv4 address spaces, right, running out that's the key driver, right, that's getting us there. There is really no other credible alternative if you want to be able to have hosts that are sitting out there that are sitting on well-known IP address space, addresses that are routable through the wide area internet. There's really no other solution. There are stopgap measures that have been deployed today with network address translation, and that technology can be stretched a bit, right, to try to make the IPv4 address space allocations of various, you know, groups and organizations to last as long as possible. But at some point, you know, many will have to bite the bullet and introduce IPv6 in various areas, right? The key thing that's driving this is, again, is just the pervasive appetite, right, of various types of computing devices, right, to be able to connect to the internet, whether it's, you know, servers, laptops, pervasive devices like cell phones, right? We have a picture here with a refrigerator that needs internet access to be able to, give you interesting tips from the manufacturer on various things. All of these things are certainly putting a stress on this connectivity. The key thing to note here is that, you know, we've been looking at this for a while, right? IPv6 is not a new standard. The standards are actually quite mature, and most major vendors have been working on IPv6 enablement, right, for multiple years. So just to put it into context, ZOS version 1 release 4 was the first time that we introduced IPv6 support on ZOS, right? So certainly most of the major vendors have been preparing for this for a very long time. Okay, moving on to chart 16 and just talking about more trends, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this so that we started late here, and I want to make sure we can get to some of the technical discussions. But we talked about growing mobility of users. You know, if you have a smartphone that's fourth generation, right, you can see all the commercials about 4G being out there. IPv6 is one of the underlying assumptions that the 4G protocol makes, and the various providers I know here in the U.S. are beginning to enable all their wireless networks for IPv6 for 4G coverage. Continued rapid growth of the internet, we talked about that just in terms of emerging geographies, right? You can look at populations in China, India, and start thinking about, you know, if every person there basically needed a internet connection, you know, that clearly is putting a lot of stress on this. As we mentioned, in Asia-Pacific, by the summer, right, they're going to be out of, you know, IP addresses. So that's been one of the geographies that's been really, you know, more proactive than others in terms of deploying IPv6 networks. Government support, governments around the world have been having various efforts to promote IPv6 adoption, anywhere from encouraging IPv6, right, to mandating IPv6. So certainly in the Asian Pacific countries and the European Commission and the EU has been focusing on that. In the U.S., we know that for the U.S. Department of Defense, has basically made it a mandate that any solutions that get bidded on for DoD type of solutions must meet very specific IPv6 requirements, right? Otherwise, you're not allowed to bid a solution there. By extension, some of those same standards are now also making their way into the remaining U.S. government agencies, where the National Institute of Standards and Technologies here has basically indicated that all government agencies need to be IPv6 compliant by a certain time frame. So more and more requirements for applications that use a push model, right, where they're visible all the time and can, you know, servers can push information to them, right, drive unique requirements, again, for having permanent IP connectivity on the web, convergence of video, voice, IP, data, I/O, all of that on IP, right, is introducing additional IP endpoints as well. Okay, just pausing just for a second there, and now we'll shift gears and getting into what is IPv6 really about. So if we jump to chart 18, I mentioned here that it is the next generation protocol. You might wonder how we went from V4 to V6. There was an experimental protocol for for version 5 that basically is obsolete. It never really got adopted, so hence the jump. The work on this has started since the early 90s. The key thing with this is that because it tries to address, one of the key things it's trying to address is a fundamental thing as what's the IP address of a given host, right? It is not backward compatible, right? We're going to have larger IP addresses, right? So IP packets look different, IP headers look different, right? So certainly it's, some invention is required here. Not backward compatible, but we'll talk about the fact that there are migration techniques that have been defined to allow coexistence of V4 and V6 for a very long time, right? This is a pretty large change, so a lot of effort has been spent on that, understanding that we can't press, the button and switch from one protocol to the other, as a big bang type of change. So the key thing that we're addressing here is addressing, right? So we'll see there that IPv4 has 32 bits to represent an IP address, right? Theoretical limit around 4 billion, practical limit around 1 billion of that, IP addresses. With IPv6, we go from 32 bits, not to 64, right? We've been known in computer technology to always go to the next power of 2. This one, I think we had a little bit more foresight. We're going from 32 bits to 128 bits. That's a pretty massive jump in terms of scalability. There's really no practical limits that we can foresee right now, right, for exhausting this address space. What you'll see here is the IPv4 address in dotted decimal that you'll see there. You'll see what an IPv6 address looks like, and it looks a little bit different, and we'll talk about that a little bit, what that representation is with these, what appear to be hex digits there separated by colons. We'll talk about that in more detail. There are other improvements with IPv6, right? There's great facilities for automatic reconfiguration of IP hosts, support to be able to more easily renumber your network from an IP perspective, things like end-to-end security, IP security, and so forth. A lot of those facilities have largely been retrofitted in various forms to IP version 4. Some of the bottom ones that we mentioned there are really IPv6 unique features, things like dealing with mobility, mobile IP clients, and being able to optimize routing for those. That's especially important for wireless types of devices. And as I mentioned before, things like the 4G protocols, assuming IPv6. And various other miscellaneous improvements to improve things like router performance and so forth. Okay. Moving on to chart 19 and taking a look at some of the key features, IPv6 has a new header, a new IP header. It is a streamlined header. The thought here is that there's a fixed length header that most routers will need to basically access, right, versus having a variable length header. And the idea here is to speed up the efficiency of routers needing to route, packets from one network to another. There are optional headers that are introduced to better architect things like fragmentation headers, security headers, and so forth. But the key thing here is to note that if you were to look at an IPv6 packet out in the network, it's going to look different than an IPv4 packet, right? The header is going to be different. Where headers are included are going to be different as well, and so forth. The next bullet talks about the fact that, one of the emphasis here was to make routing of IP packets more efficient, right? So the thought here is that, routers are not allowed to fragment packets any longer, right? The assumption here is that IP endpoints, know what the minimum MTU is and will build packets, right, that will require no fragmentation anywhere along the IP route from one host to the other. So that basically means that, today with IP version 4, you have a notion of path MTU discovery that allows you to do this. With V6, it's basically mandated, right? If routers get something that they would need to fragment, they would basically drop it, right? That's basically the effect of that. The extended IP address space. You'll see here written out in decimal, how many IP addresses the IPv6 address space gives you. Right? I'm not going to read that number out to you, but it's a very large number. The key thing here is in terms of looking at IP addresses, and we saw them depicted earlier, and we'll discuss what that looks like, but we basically have 128 bits to play with. So at the very bottom, you'll see what the format of that is. So perhaps, starting on the leftmost, what we basically have is a network prefix that can be X number of bits out of that. And that's really quite similar to your subnets that you have today or, network types of delineations that you have today where you have X number of consecutive bits, right, for IPv4 address spaces, addresses that designate what that network or subnet is. So you'll see there that's basically, that first 64 bits is basically split across a subnet ID and a network prefix. Typically, the network prefix is what you would be allocated by an ISP. You would get a range of addresses. And then within that, you would have the flexibility of defining one or more, subnets, depending on what that range was. And you have some flexibility on how you define those subnets, just like you do today, right? With IP version 4, you can decide how big each subnet needs to be and what granularity and so forth. So that left part is really quite similar in some respects to your subnets that you're relying on today. The rightmost part, the remaining 64 bits, is a unique approach with IP version 6. The idea there is that typically what that would be is the MAC address, right, that identifies the network interface card that the host is plugged into. So it could be the burned-in MAC address or a virtual MAC that's being used to represent that network interface card. Now, you might look at that and say, wow, that's interesting. Why would I do that? Well, when we talked about auto-configuration capabilities that IPv6 has right out of the box, that's one of the neat features is that in some cases you can actually have a host come up and build its IPv6 address in a unique fashion if it just knew what the subnet and network prefix was that it was supposed to belong on. So view it as DHCP type of processing, right, but that's now built into the protocol itself. Okay, so that's what an IPv6 address is basically looks like. If we jump to chart 20, we'll talk about here on, how do we depict it and reports and so forth. Today, you all are very familiar with dotted decimal IP addresses. We'll see here that we basically represent IPv6 addresses in text format using 8 segments of 4 hex digits, right? So 16 bits separated by colons. So sometimes you'll hear this notation referred to as colon hex notation, okay? So what we basically see there is a full global IPv6 address depicted out there, and if you count all those bytes, you'll see that there's 8 segments, and you multiply that by the 4 hex digits, you'll figure out that we have 128 bits of significance here, right? There are some shortcuts to this. If you have an IPv6 address that has consecutive segments of these 4 that are 0, and they have to be on a segment boundary, you can take a shorthand notation, so you'll see here that second representation basically has a colon, colon, back-to-back. That basically indicates that there's consecutive 0 segments in there. That shorthand notation can only be used absolutely once within an IPv6 address, right? Because if it was introduced multiple times, there'd be some ambiguity. Okay? Now, the thing that you can do here is if you're talking about a part of the IPv6 address, let's say the subnet, if you will, you have a notion of being able to represent that with the slash notation that you see there, where it has a slash 64, that basically indicates that the subnet significance here is the first 64 bits of this 128-bit address. Now, a prefix alone is represented as the interface ID and then all zeros, right? So if you're just looking at a subnet prefix by itself, right, this is how you could represent it. The trailing colon colon there is basically consecutive zero segments. Now, the one thing that's probably clear here is that if you look at that fully populated IPv6 address, that typing these in can be time-consuming, error-prone, right, what have you. So the key thing here is that the use of DNS when you get into the IPv6 space, even for things that you may have used literal IP addresses before, really becomes no longer an option, right? You definitely want to be able to exploit DNS, right, to instead of having to type these addresses in manually. Okay, moving on to the next chart. So some special addresses that you ought to be aware of. So there is the first address there that shows basically :, and then /128. That basically, if you think about the :, and nothing else, that basically means it's all zeros, right? That's the in at or any address that we have with version 4 today. It's the unspecified address. If a server comes up and listens to this address, it basically says that, I'm sorry, if an application comes up on a system and listens on this address on a given port, it's basically saying that it's willing to accept inbound connections using any IP address, right, that the client can use to reach this host. The loopback address is different, so gone is the 127.0.0.1, but here we basically have the one address is the designated IPv6 loopback address. Then you'll see a series of addresses that start with an F, as in Frank, that basically are reserved addresses for special use. There is a reserve range there for multicast addresses for IPv6. There is this FE address prefix followed by an 80. That's a link local address. That's a unique address that basically gets automatically configured on every IPv6 host and primarily used for initial contact, initialization processing onto an IPv6 network, typically not an IP address that you would be using for anything other than network diagnosis. It's a unique address in that it's completely automatically configured. And you'll see there that it has a fixed prefix, right, regardless of what network, you know, you bring up this device on. So it only has meaning on a local IPv6 link or local area network, if you will. The bottom part of it gets populated typically by the MAC address of the NIC that's basically connected to the IPv6 network. Again, not something you're going to use for most flows, but from a network administration perspective, it's something that you need to be aware of because as a network administrator, you may have use for them. But these are addresses that, you know, for instance, never go into DNS or anything along those lines. They're not routable addresses across different networks and so forth. The next address that starts with an FC and then followed 00 is a very interesting address. This is a unique local address. This basically is an address that's not routable or, you know, you cannot advertise it in the wide area internet, but rather within your enterprise. And if you think about this, this is very similar, right, to the IPv4 private address space that's there today, right? Addresses like 10 dot, right, anything, right? You can basically have the flexibility to use within your Z enterprise, right? But you can never have any of those IP addresses, you know, flow out to the external internet. Right, so those are addresses that you can use within your Z enterprise as long as those hosts never require any external connectivity. Those are key because as you start thinking about perhaps deploying test environments with IPv6, that's a useful way to allocate some IP addresses without necessarily getting, you know, getting formal addresses allocated from an ISP and so forth. The next address, the IPv4 mapped address, you'll see there it has a special trailing suffix there of FFFF. The key there is we'll see is this is a very useful tool that enables coexistence. If you want to be able to represent a V4 traditional address in an IPv6 format, that allows you to do that, and we'll see examples where that's useful. And finally, what you'll see is at the bottom there is what global IP addresses are for V6. So basically, anything that doesn't fit the earlier criteria is a global IPv6 address. The range that's starting now starts off with a 2, but that's not going to be, you know, as they allocate more and more addresses, you're going to see that there's going to be a various, that prefix is going to change over time. Okay? So that's a quick summary. Just the key messages here are there are some special reserved addresses, right, and then there's two key pools of addresses that you'll be mostly concerned about, the unique local addresses and the global unique IPv6 addresses. Okay, moving along to chart 22, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because we are running a little bit short on time, but the key thing here is we did talk about IPv6 has some built-in enhanced functionality when you compare it to V4. One of the key things that it can do, as I mentioned, is IP auto-configuration, right? So the idea is you can bring up an IP host with an IPv6 interface, they can figure out what the network prefix is that it needs to be attached to from routers that are sitting on the on that network that it's basically attached to, and then can automatically not initialize the Type IPv6 interface. That's where it uses this link local address that I mentioned before that it basically builds dynamically. Once it builds that address, it has a communication path with anybody else sitting on that subnet, including the routers. The routers can then advertise what the 64-bit prefix is for this network, and that basically allows now the server, right, to be able to initialize with its unique IPv6 address on that network. So if you think about this, this is quite similar to what DHCP does today for IPv4, except that you don't really need a DHCP server to go do this. Things like duplicate address detection is built into the protocol. If two hosts try to come up with the same IP addresses on the same network, that won't work, right? And it will get flagged, right? You're not going to get unpredictable results, but rather you will know that one of them failed to initialize in that way. Other things like address resolution, today you have things like ARP. There's IPv6 protocols like neighbor solicitations and neighbor advertisements, neighbor discovery that basically allow you to do all of that. There's enhanced communication on routers that are sitting on the network and their availability. So if a router, if you have multiple routers on a given network and one of them goes down, the endpoints on that network can figure that out quickly and can switch off to use the other available path to the router, right, without elaborate, you know, dynamic routing protocols and things of that nature, you know, to be able to achieve that, right? So certainly a lot of key features there. Now, moving on to chart 24, we'll talk a little bit about IPv6 penetration, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, probably leave this mostly for your reference. I think we talked about most of the major things that are driving IPv6 deployment today, you know, everything from the U.S. in terms of the DoD and NIST and various other geographies, as we mentioned, and industries that are driving this. There is an increased level of focus on certification for IPv6, right? And we'll talk about that in a subsequent chart a little bit more, because as these requirements get rolled out, there needs to be an easy way to detect is this product or platform IPv6 ready or not. So we'll see that there's some common standards that basically govern that. Okay, moving to the next chart here, you'll see chart 25 here shows IPv6 allocations that IANA has made today, right? So that process has been kicked off for several years now. You can go out there and obtain IPv6 addresses. This chart is just showing the rate of IPv6 addresses that are being allocated and advertised, known out there on the Internet. And you can see that's there just by the slope of the curve that we're on an upswing there. Moving on to the next chart, chart 26 here, we're going to really shift now focus and start talking about, okay, where are we today with IPv6 and where are we headed? And this chart here basically kind of shows you that, in the past we basically had that leftmost, uppermost quadrant where it was all, the whole world was IPv4, right? We really transitioned from that. We're not there anymore. We're really in stage one where there are pockets of IPv6 deployment out there, right? As we mentioned, mobile devices, that's now, right? Various geographies, they're pushing IPv6 networks today. But by and large, right, there are pockets of V6 that are being enabled. The Internet as we know it is primarily IPv4, right? But that's where we are today, and we think we're beginning to move pretty quickly to stage two, where we start to see larger IPv6 deployment, where we'll start seeing IPv6 traffic now on the wide area, big Internet, right, rather than having it confined in specialized networks, that we'll start seeing IPv6 traffic flowing, right, on a much wider scale. And then at some point, we'll get to stage three, right, where the IPv6 network really, the Internet becomes primarily IPv6, and we have pockets of IPv4 left around. Now, we will say it will take a while, right, but before we reach that stage. Okay, so that sets it at a high level where we believe we are right now and where we're headed. So the next topic, looking at chart 27, starts talking about is how do we begin to migrate to IPv6 and some of the key coexistence issues. Okay, so on chart 28 here, basically there's two high-level things, topics we'll be discussing. One is, you know, from a networking perspective, right? I have my IPv4 network today. I want to start deploying IPv6 connectivity in various pockets in a controlled manner. How do I get traffic to traverse, you know, my wide area network that's perhaps IPv6 enabled? So we'll be talking about technologies that basically allow you to do that. The key thing here, as we'll see, is that IPv6 has been developed in such a way where IPv6 and IPv4 can coexist on the same physical network, right, concurrently. We can actually use connectivity, either V4 or V6 connectivity, to enable traffic to flow over it, even if it's not the native protocol. So we'll talk about tunneling types of capabilities of things like IPv6 over IPv4. We'll talk about a concept called a dual mode stack, basically a TCP/IP protocol stack that supports V4 and V6. And we'll see that that's a key technology that gets used not only in this scenario, but also in scenario two. Scenario two starts looking at it not so much from a network perspective of pushing bytes across the network, but it asks the question of, you know, is IPv6 visibility, you know, does it stop at the network? And we'll see here that it really does not. It permeates all the way up to every socket application that's been developed today that's been known to be using IPv4 needs to have some level of awareness, right, or there are some level of considerations when you're deploying IPv6. And we'll see that there's various technologies there, right, that can help you mitigate the fact that you're not going to get all those pieces there, you know, on day one. So we'll talk about those in a little bit more detail as well. So moving on to chart 29. So here's the key thing, right? It's, you know, is IPv6 just an exercise that you undertake from a network engineering perspective, right? Is it like going from 1 gig to 10 gig? I updated my network and I'm done. And the answer is no, it would have been nice if that's all it was, but there's a lot more considerations to it. So the key thing to get started with here is the fact that the entire network infrastructure does have to get updated to support IPv6, right? So that means, you know, all the new features we talked about before, things like neighbor discovery, auto addressing and configuration features of IPv6, from a routing perspective, there's obviously changes there to static routing and dynamic routing. If you're using OSPF, there's a new version of OSPF that's enabled for IPv6 explicitly. If you have ICMP types of capabilities today with V4, you have the similar ones with version 6. From a name server perspective, right, you have host name to IP address resolution. There's certainly changes there when you introduce IPv6. DHCP infrastructure may need to be updated and so forth. So certainly things like any layer 3 router you have out there, there's impacts. Firewalls, right, those are at a high level routing components as well would need to be updated. If you have intrusion detection devices, right, that process IP traffic, those obviously need to be aware of this. Any application layer gateways that sit, you know, in between tiers of applications you may have in your enterprise may need to be updated as well. A key thing there is to discuss here is key assumption is that the actual physical network that you have, right, doesn't really need to be updated typically, right, because the same physical wires, the same NICs, the same switches ought to be able to carry V4 and V6 traffic concurrently, right? So it's basically another protocol flowing over your existing physical network deployment. Okay, each IP host that's plugged into your network does need to be enabled for IPv6. So the TCP/IP stack certainly needs to enable support for IPv6. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about this dual mode stack as the prevalent implementation of that's out there. Okay, I apologize. I left off the next to last bullet there. I'll talk about the stack access for IPv6. The next thing that's really an annoying reality is that we don't stop there. So we don't stop at the portion where the TCP/IP protocol stack has to enable for V6. The annoying fact is that IP addresses are known all the way up to application layers. So any application that uses the Sockets API to communicate over TCP/IP today would typically require a change in order for it to support IPv6 as well. It's something that we wish was not true, but unfortunately it is. So it permeates all the way up to the application layer. Now, when we say that, it doesn't necessarily mean that every application you own needs to be modified for IPv6, right? If you're using middleware that's performing all the TCP/IP communications, right, that middleware is enabled for IPv6. That could be transparent to higher-level applications that you deploy within those execution environments. Okay, so shifting to chart 30, talk about what does a TCP/IP host have to do to enable for IPv6. So typically, the way that this is done is the TCP/IP protocol stack is enhanced to become a dual-mode TCP/IP stack. Key thing to note here is, right, when we look at this, we are not talking about here about a multiple stack environment on ZOS, anything like Common IO. We're basically talking about a single TCP/IP stack, but that basically has capabilities to be able to support both V4 and V6 network connections and allows applications to be able to communicate over V4 and V6. So if we start at the very top here, you basically have an application that can be either enabled for IP version 4 as it is today only, and we'll see that that application, when it creates sockets, it creates sockets that are bound to the IPv4 address family. That's what AF underbar INET implies. Okay? Now, applications that are IPv6 enabled, the thing that they will do differently is they will create a socket that's AF underbar INET 6. It basically indicates that that application is enabled for both V6 and V4 communications. So the nice thing is that applications don't have to create multiple sockets if they want to talk to V4 and V6 partners, but they can do that with a single socket. Now, underneath that, what we see is we have a common layer for TCP and UDP. So the TCP and UDP layers and protocols largely remain unchanged, right? TCP does what it does today for V4. It will retransmit packets. It will acknowledge packets. Those TCP headers are largely unchanged, regardless of whether you're on V4 or V6, okay? But when you get to the next layer down with the IP layer, that's where we have a brand-new IP layer. Just like we had IPv4, that becomes the path that we have today. On the left-hand side, we have a whole new layer to deal with IPv6. And that layer now speaks all the new IPv6 protocols, things like neighbor discovery, multicast listener discovery, stateless address, autoconfig, all those features that I mentioned before. For ICMP processing, we have ICMP version 3, which is the complement to the ICMP we have today for version 4. Okay, so those two layers are surely unique. Now, as we flow to the lower layers, we really start reaching some additional commonality. So we still have device drivers and interfaces that reflect our IPv6 connectivity and our IPv4 connectivity. But in this picture here, right, at a minimum, we have a single network interface card that we configure with two virtual network interfaces, one for V6 and one for V4. So that could be a single OSA card, right, that's depicted there, that we define with two network interfaces on a ZOS system, one for V4 and one for V6. Okay? Not unlike the notion where today you can have multiple virtual network interfaces on the same OSA card for a single ZOS image. In this case, it's one for ZOS, V4 and one V6. Okay? So the key thing here is applications that are IPv6 enabled here on the top, assuming we have connectivity, can talk to V4 and V6 clients. We'll see that IPv4 only applications may be more limited in what they can accomplish. I think this may be a logical place to stop